is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You realize that most of the collateral is owned by men. So even if a woman wants to go and access finance in a bank or microfinance, most of the time they'll be asking for security, which would be in the form of a car, in form of land. Then unfortunately, you find that women don't have any security or collateral to secure that finance.
That was Mercy Kinoti, a Kenyan female entrepreneur, on the challenges facing women as they try to start businesses. Details coming up. Also, women's rights group in Mali sue the government for not protecting girls from circumcision. And Ethiopia's government confirms for the first time that scores of women have been raped in the country's North Tigray region. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has delivered his fifth State of the Nation address. Lacking its usual pomp and ceremony due to COVID restrictions, he delivered his speech yesterday to a handful of members of parliament in Cape Town. Vicky Stark reports from there.
Ramaphosa confirmed that South Africa will now use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. He thanked local scientists who discovered that the vaccine from AstraZeneca, which was meant to be rolled out this week, was only 22% effective against a new strain discovered late last year.
We have secured 9 million doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The first batch of some 80,000 doses will arrive in the country next week. In addition, we have secured 12 million vaccines from the COVAX facility. This will be complementing other vaccines that are available to South Africa through the African Union's Acquisition Task Team facility that we set up. Pfizer has committed 20 million vaccine doses, commencing with deliveries at the end of the first quarter.
The Unemployment Insurance Fund, Temporary Employer Employee Relief Scheme, and the special COVID-19 grant of 350 Rand per month are being extended.
This has proven to be an effective and efficient short-term measure to reduce the immediate impact on the livelihoods of poor South Africans who are out of work.
Despite economic doldrums, Ramaphosa was upbeat about investments.
In November last year, we held our third South African Investment Conference to review the implementation of previous commitments and to generate new investment into our economy. Even under the difficult economic circumstances, the investment conference managed to raise 108 billion rand in additional investment commitments from a number of investors.
A big deterrent for many investors is the erratic power supply. Ramaphosa says they're addressing the problem with national utility, Eskom.
Eskom estimates that without additional capacity, there will be an electricity supply shortfall of between 4,000 and 6,000 megawatts over the next 5 years, as our old coal-fired power stations reach the end of their life. As part of the measures to address this shortfall, we will, in the coming weeks, issue a request for proposals for 2,600 megawatts from wind and solar energy as part of bid window 5. This will be followed by another bid window in August of 2021.
The main opposition parties have criticized him for not giving enough specifics on Eskom and not mentioning the other state-owned enterprises like embattled South African Airways. However, he was vocal about corruption, saying it remains one of the greatest impediments to South Africa's growth. He referred to anti-corruption hearings being chaired by Judge Raymond Zondo.
The revelations from the Zondo Commission of Inquiry lay bare the extent of state capture and related corruption. We have started the implementation of the National Anti-Corruption Strategy, which lays the basis for a comprehensive and integrated society-wide response to corruption. We will shortly be appointing the members of the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council.
Ramaphosa quoted Nelson Mandela and recited a bit of Maya Angelou's poem, Still I Rise.
Out of the hearts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling. I bear in the tide, leaving behind minds of terror and fear. I rise into a daybreak that's wondrously clear. I rise, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, and I rise. Close quotes. Now, people of South Africa, it is your country that calls on you to rise.
Critics say Ramaphosa is good at talking the talk, but not so good at walking the walk. They're hoping the finance minister's budget speech on the 24th of February will reflect real reforms. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
South Africa's leading medical minds say the country is reaching the end of an intense second wave of COVID-19. But it is not time to relax, as they add that a third wave, which could be even stronger, is almost inevitable. Since last March, South Africa has registered almost 1.5 million infections and more than 47,000 deaths from the coronavirus. Darren Taylor has more.
At this stage, say scientists, South Africa can't get enough vaccines that are effective against the variant first identified in the country in December, fast enough to prevent a third wave. They predict this will hit in about 2 to 3 months. But for now, says the epidemiologist who's leading South Africa's scientific response to COVID-19, Salim Abdul Karim, the nation can breathe a bit.
If we look at the way in which the second wave grew, it's a reflection of just the sheer burden of clinical illness, the hospitalizations and the clinical and the severe disease that leads to death. Barely 3 weeks ago, we were looking at a situation where across the board, our country was in the red. We are now doing quite well in the way in which the numbers have come down across the board.
Not long ago, South Africa was recording almost 21,000 new cases and about 3,000 deaths a day. Karim says the country's best way forward is the mass distribution of vaccines that are clinically proven to work against the 501Y V2 variant. He says the current jabs work well to prevent the original virus. The Pfizer vaccine, for example, shows 90% efficacy. The scientist says even the AstraZeneca shot, which South Africa has been forced to abandon for the time being because it's not as effective as they expected against the new variant, is a good vaccine.
In fact, if you look at AstraZeneca, at 2 weeks after the second dose, they had zero hospitalizations. So there's no question across the board, these vaccines work really well in preventing severe disease and preventing hospitalization. But that's with the existing variants. They were designed for the existing variants.
In lab tests, says Karim, the Pfizer jab and that made by the Moderna firm did reasonably well against the new variant.
We are seeing a diminished neutralization, diminished killing capability in the blood of people who receive Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, but not to the extent that it looks like it's compromising these vaccines' ability to kill the virus. But remember, we have no clinical efficacy evidence against the 501YV2 variant. These are just laboratory studies.
He says all three viral vector vaccines made by AstraZeneca, Pfizer, and Moderna struggle against the variant first identified in South Africa.
Overall efficacy for all of the countries combined was 67%. However, when we look at the South African data on its own, it's concerning that it's down to 22%. So now we're seeing that
the government's considering using China's Sinopharm vaccine, but Karim says its initial results aren't very promising.
They use a live virus lab assay, and they show a small reduction, 1.6-fold, against the 501YV2 variant. Again, no clinical efficacy evidence against the variant we have in South Africa.
The first clinical evidence of a vaccine's effectiveness in combating the variant came from the Novavax company.
The evidence showed that this vaccine is 89% effective in the UK, but only 49% effective in South Africa. So the answer to that question, are protein subunit vaccines effective against the variant? Well, partially. The Novavax vaccine's clinical efficacy raises quite a lot of concern because of such a drastic drop in efficacy.
Karim says the only clinical evidence that a vaccine is effective in preventing hospitalizations and deaths related to the variant is from Johnson & Johnson. Fortunately, says Karim, that's the one that will hopefully kickstart South Africa's vaccine rollout next week. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
African leaders are urging women on the continent to invest more in business and take advantage of the digital revolution and technological innovations. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
At a recent African Business Forum, the leaders, including Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, emphasized the importance of African governments in empowering women to create successful businesses.
Let me begin by saying, I don't know whether I can call myself a feminist, but I do believe that women have the same capacity, if not greater capacity, than their male counterparts.
Kenyatta stressed the need to expand women's participation in all sectors of the economy, adding that access to education was key in achieving that goal. But there are other impediments. Mercy Kinoti is a Kenyan female entrepreneur.
One of the major challenges that is cross-cutting within the region is that women lack the know-how in terms of opportunities that exist within any particular sector, and we tend to shy away from engaging in business because we assume that business is for men. If we engage in the business, we tend to take the small deals and leave the big deals for the men.
Additionally, Kinoti says women across Africa are disproportionately vulnerable and continue to face discrimination.
The credit opportunities that exist are not very favorable for women. You realize that most of the collateral is owned by men. So even if a woman wants to go and access finance in a bank or microfinance, most of the time they'll be asking for security, which would be in the form of a car, in form of land. And unfortunately, you find that women don't have any security or collateral to secure that finance. That becomes a big hindrance.
The economic damage from COVID-19 and the difficulties in meeting the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, including youth employment, also are significant challenges affecting women on the continent. Vera Songwe is the Executive Secretary of the Economic Commission for Africa.
We have seen and we have heard and we have all been in so many different forums where everybody has told us of the magnitude of COVID, how it is affecting the poor. It is going to turn about another 20 million more people into poverty. But then there is some hope. And where is that hope coming from? At least when we talk about Africa. When we talk about Africa, we see some hope on the technology side. We see hope on the internet things. And we thought, after talking about the downside, let's begin to think about the Africa that's hopeful and the Africa that can get out of it.
She praised Kenya as a beacon of hope for young African innovators is one of the fastest growing economies in sub-Saharan Africa. The East African nation ranks among the leading centers for innovation and entrepreneurship on the continent. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. African leaders are urging women to invest more in business. Ethiopia's government confirms for the first time that scores of women have been raped in the country's North Tigray region. And women's rights groups in Mali are suing the government for not protecting girls from circumcision. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Women's rights groups in Mali are suing the government for not doing enough to protect girls from circumcision, known as female genital mutilation or FGM. As Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako, activists say the case shows how difficult it is to change the practice in Mali, saying it has zero tolerance for sexual violence.
Malian dancer Fatimata Bagayoko is also an activist who speaks out against female circumcision, also named by the damage it causes, female genital mutilation, or FGM. The United Nations says Mali has the highest rate of FGM in West Africa. 83% of Malian women undergo the cultural practice, which is often forced on young girls. Bagayoko was a young infant when the procedure was performed on her, but she says it took a while to realize her trauma. Speaking from next to her outdoor dance studio, among colorfully painted homes in a small neighborhood next to Bamako's abandoned railroad, Bagayoko describes the moment when she realized what had been done to her at just 7 days old. It was when I went to the village, she says, and I saw these little girls running around who were taken by force so that they would be cut. And the tears that these girls, the fear that they had, she says, that I read on their faces, it was there that I understood. Women's rights groups filed papers in December to sue the Malian government in the Court of Justice for Regional Bloc ECOWAS for failing to stop FGM. The Malian Association for the Monitoring and Orientation of Traditional Practices, AMSOPT, is one of the plaintiffs. Brahima Balo, the project manager at AMSOPT, speaks from the courtyard outside the office in a quiet Bamako neighborhood. He says, we, who are the defenders of human rights, who defend women and children, we think that the state has the responsibility and the duty to protect these girls, he says, who didn't ask to be cut. Mali's activists went to ECOWAS after decades of struggling against conservative religious leaders who blocked attempts to outlaw FGM. The UN Children's Fund says about a fifth of villages have agreed to stop FGM, and the lawsuit could open needed talks on banning it. Sylvie Fouet, a UNICEF Mali representative, explained over Skype how this case could potentially impact the fight against FGM in Mali.
So we need to move the next stage to encourage leaders and communities to stand for that and obviously get the 80% missing. So that conversation and that exposure may help to do so.
Meanwhile, Bagayoko teaches dance as a way to connect with girls and raise awareness of FGM. She also visits villages and says she speaks to elders about the practice from a place of cultural understanding. Every year, every era has its reality, she says. When they did this, they had their reality at the time. But, she says, they didn't think of the consequences that this can pose. A government spokesperson and the Ministry of Women and Children did not respond to requests for comment. The ECOWAS court has not yet set a date for hearing the case against Mali's government. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government has confirmed that scores of women have been raped in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. According to Reuters, the rapes occurred in the chaotic aftermath of armed conflict last November that ousted the local ruling party. The state-appointed Ethiopian Human Rights Commission came out with a report saying 108 rapes have been reported in Tigray in the last 2 months, with half in the regional capital, Mekelle. Officials say that only includes incidents in the capital, Mekelle, and the nearby town of Quiha. The Rights Commission points out that many of the rapes were likely to have gone unreported because local structures such as police and health facilities are no longer in place. The rapes reflected the dire conditions for many people in Tigray, especially children, amid shortages of food, water, shelter, sanitation, and medical care. A warning by the World Health Organization that the COVID-19 pandemic could harm efforts to eradicate malaria appears to be coming true in Nigeria. Nigerian officials say people are refusing to get treatment for fear of catching the virus at a clinic. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Fatima Muhammad is in her home at a camp for displaced people in Abuja, tending to her two sons who are currently down with malaria. She says she can't afford huge hospital bills and is afraid that taking them to the hospital could potentially expose them to COVID-19 or result in misdiagnosis. I don't have money to take them to the hospital. And again, at the hospital, they'll easily call it coronavirus. I don't have money for that. Malaria and COVID-19 present similar symptoms, but fear and stigma attached to the pandemic are reasons many like Fatima are seeking alternatives to hospital treatment. Health experts say in-hospital visits for malaria declined significantly in Nigeria since reporting the coronavirus in February 2020. The World Health Organization's World Malaria Report 2020 suggested the pandemic is threatening years of progress made against malaria and warned that death rates from the mosquito-borne disease could double. WHO malaria consultant Linda Ozo says disruption of preventive measures is to blame.
The use of long-lasting insecticidal nets and seasonal malaria chemo prevention and prevention of malaria in pregnancy were interrupted. So assuming all these preventive interventions were interrupted, then it was expected, and the model showed that there will be a very negative effect.
Nigeria accounts for about a quarter of malaria cases worldwide and about 23% of deaths globally. Even before COVID-19 hit, many Nigerians took malaria less seriously, says Adeboyega Adeogo, who heads pharmaceutical operations at Wella Health, a Nigerian health company focusing on eliminating malaria.
Due to advances in health and technology, many people resolve malaria within days. So you see that many Nigerians now take it with a lot of levity because of the ease of treatment. But if they decide to avoid it, then it now becomes a major issue. And you now start seeing the more serious complications that are associated with malaria.
Nigeria's National Malaria Elimination Program planned to provide 31 million citizens with free mosquito nets, anti-malaria drugs, and malaria testing last year. But disruptions caused by COVID-19 meant they reached only half of their goal. That has increased concern that malaria, along with COVID-19, will remain a threat to Nigerians for years to come. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.